This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of New Books in History. Today I'll be speaking with Darren Dochuk, author of the new book, Anointed with Oil, How Christianity and Crude Made Modern America. Published by Basic Books this month, Anointed with Oil traces the intersection between petroleum and American religion from the 1860s through to the present day. America's faith in crude, Dochuk shows, often mirrors the country's faith in Christ, turning this resource into a symbol of American exceptionalism. Darren, welcome to this show.
Hi, Stephen. Good to be with you.
Great. So you've written a book on Sunbelt evangelicalism and several edited collections on American religious history more broadly. What brought you to the study of the link between oil and American religion?
Well, for my first book, as you just said, I spent time across the Southwest and in Southern California researching the migration of people from Texas and Arkansas, Oklahoma, during and after the Depression to Southern California. And then I charted the way in which their kind of religious and political values were grafted on to a new conservatism that would culminate in Reagan's election as governor and then as president in 1980. So naturally, the more I got interested in and invested in the study of the Southwest in particular, I was certainly aware of evangelical churches and evangelicalism. That's what I was writing about. But I kept coming across powerful oil men who were heavily invested in churches, in philanthropy, and in the politics that I was studying. And at that point, I thought it might be interesting to see how oil and religion fit together. And initially, I thought I would simply follow the money, track these oil men and just see how they were, how their monies and how their influence were shaping American Protestantism, especially evangelicalism in the Southwest. Then as I got into the project, I found more ties, more interesting ties between religion and oil. And I also, of course, extended the study back all the way to the Civil War. So that's really the origins of the book. And I also, as I say in the book, grew up in Alberta, Canada, which is the Texas of Canada, really, where there was plenty of religion and oil. And so I guess knew intuitively that there would be lots of terrain to cover.
Great, fantastic. So in the book, you sort of outline different links between religion and capitalism and how that shaped the oil industry. Could you outline for us the different ways that different theological kind of thoughts interacted with particular forms of capitalism?
Well, you're right. I kind of track that in multiple registers. I was, for instance, taken with the very origins of oil being the 1860s during the Civil War. That's when oil was discovered in Western Pennsylvania. And so at the highest altitude, really, the anointing with oil that America enjoys is really embedded in a crucial moment in the nation's history. One of great crisis and tragedy. But then as America emerges from the Civil War, of course, it's going to reimagine itself as a powerful nation state, with a powerful economy. And that economy is going to be driven in many ways by the petroleum industry. And so going forward, oil is in many ways imagined as the lifeblood of a new nation state, one that aspires to expand its interest and influence globally. So that's one way in which oil is really theologized by the nation writ large. At the lower level, lower altitude, as you point out, I'm really interested in the way ways in which religion and business work together within the oil industry. What I am emphasizing throughout, really the dramatic tension of the book, is the competition between two different sectors in the oil industry. We often think of big oil as hegemonic and homogenous, but in fact, the American oil industry is divided in really clear ways. Certainly, the first generation of oilmen were wildcatters as a whole. In that case, by that I mean they were interested in drilling wildcat wells, discovery wells, really pushing the envelope of oil production in Pennsylvania. The industry that takes shape becomes quite chaotic. American oil is ruled by a canon of land rights. It's called the rule of capture, which is unique to the United States in that it allowed individuals really to chase and pursue and to capture oil at a great pace and on their terms. It was really a great equalizer, if you will. That produced a very chaotic industry, one that was doing great damage to oil's resources, draining pools and pressure before all the oil had been drained. This was a great worry to many oilmen, and one in particular, John D. Rockefeller, comes along and says, I need to bring some order to this chaotic industry. And as we know, he does so through various means, creates a large monopoly, and basically squeezes thousands of smaller oil producers out of the business. And those become what we know as independent oilmen, and they are going to move west of the Mississippi at the end of the 19th century and be instrumental in finding unprecedented pools of oil in Texas and California and Oklahoma. And so subsequently through the 20th century, we're going to see these two sectors, major oil represented by the Rockefellers, Standard Oil, and then after 1911, the offshoots of Standard Oil. And on the other hand, we're going to see the independent oilmen of the Southwest. And it's in that competition that much of the key pivots in oil and oil politics is going to take place during the 20th century. Where does religion fit into that? Pit these two corporate bodies against each other, also in the church, churches and the pews and pulpits and in philanthropy that has also been so crucial to American life in the 20th century. John D. Rockefeller and especially his son are going to be heavily invested in what I call a civil religion of crude. And by that, I mean they are interested in a kind of a international ecumenism, much like their business tactics of broadening influence. They look to do so within the church by expanding the missionary endeavors across the globe, and by doing so in partnership across denominational lines, in some ways centralizing and consolidating Protestantism itself, and propagating a social gospel as well that sees the duty of the Christian to use one's economic and political clout to transform the world in preparation for Christ's return. That liberal Protestant mainline of major oil is going to be opposed by the kind of much more radical evangelical or wildcat Christianity, as I call it, of the independent oilmen based in the Southwest. They're going to oppose Rockefeller not just in business, but also in the church as well. They are going to hold firm to more conservative, kind of fundamental values. They are going to uphold kind of traditional orthodoxies, one of them being, of course, the individual's right to understand Scripture and to have a personal relationship with Christ, to have a personal encounter with an active Creator. Again, this being a very fiercely independent enterprise in its own right. And they are going to support missionaries that preach that gospel. They're going to support churches and build ministries with their money and their influence that are really going to shape the 20th century American experience as well in very profound ways. And it's that clash that is going to transform American Christianity itself.
Fantastic. So you mentioned briefly there Rockefeller's support for missionaries. So I was wondering sort of more broadly how this this division naturalized American imperialism, particularly towards the end of the 19th century.
Speaking of Rockefeller in particular?
Just generally the link between religion and oil.
Well, the civil religion of crude, as I call it, which really is a Rockefeller inspiration, this notion that the power and influence and the financial capacity that oil brings to Americans, to large major companies such as Standard Oil, and the ways in which they imagine utilizing that, the Rockefellers in particular, is to again, very much as you say, naturalize the American imperial project. And that project is to expand economic interests, but to also do so with a sense of kind of a civilizing Christianization approach, trying to, again, create the ability of humanity itself to be uplifted through modernization, through economic development, but also through appreciation for kind of the essentials of a Christian democracy. So I track that in a number of different ways. For instance, the Rockefellers' influence in China in the 19-teens and 1920s is absolutely essential to reimagining the missionary project there that American Protestants associated with the mainline have brought to that developing society. I also look at mid-century, the work of Aramco, which is, of course, as we know now, the most profitable oil business, the most profitable company in the world. Well, it is an offshoot of Standard California and Texaco and a number of other major oil companies that come out of really the Rockefeller ore. And while, of course, Aramco is most interested in drilling for oil in Saudi Arabia in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and into the 1960s, the corporate culture itself, I show, in many ways embodies kind of this blending of kind of this missionary impulse, if you will, through capitalist endeavor and through the spread of Western values. Within the corporate culture of Aramco are operating numerous managers and executives who themselves are very kind of adhere to the liberal Protestant ecumenism practiced by the Rockefellers, and within their own work in building up Aramco and selling Aramco to the world, they are doing so out of their own kind of faith-based initiative. So those are a couple examples, and I hope that helps clarify for you just how that works its way through the American imperial project across the 20th century.
Great. Thanks very much. In the late 19th century and early 20th century, we have a sharp backlash against Rockefeller's monopolizing tendencies. And so we have muckraking journalism, etc. I was wondering if religion played any important part in this sharp turn against Rockefeller and the sort of broader national culture.
It sure did. And, you know, throughout our history of oil, modern America, there have always been those who have seen this material resource as a curse, not a blessing. And so in addition to kind of tracking the contestation between these two branches of oil and the church, I also track really a third kind of aspect of this story, and that is the way in which critics of oil, in their own way, kind of bring their moral fervency and their theologies with them to their muckraking, to their critiques of oil. At the turn of the century, of course, turn of the 20th century, the power of muckraking journalism, of kind of this highly sensationalistic but also morally charged journalism, was carried out by a number of figures. And the most important for the history of oil, of course, is Ida Tarbell, a very fascinating individual, one in which I was really drawn to in my research and writing. She has been written about before, but no one had really kind of worked through her own diaries and sources to show how, even as she brought her moral fervency to her journalism, she did so also with some clear kind of theological insights coming out of a Methodism that was socially active, socially aware. She eventually evolves into more of a Quaker belief system, always, though, looking at the power of Rockefeller and big oil as a blight, not just in American business, but a blight in the church. It represents a ruthlessness. It represents a destructive force, destructive to nature, destructive to humanity, including her own father, who was a small oil producer, squeezed out of the business, quite tragically, by Rockefeller. And so she wears her kind of religiosity. She shoulders it and channels it for her muckraking journalism, through her muckraking journalism. And of course, in doing so, is going to redefine the oil business itself by awakening Americans to what she deems the evils of the Rockefeller Empire. And ultimately, that's going to funnel into politics, into the courts, and Standard Oil, as a result, will, by 1911, be forced by the Supreme Court to disband, to demand now at this point, both in public opinion and in the courts, to dismantle the monopoly and the evil monopoly that Rockefeller represents.
So moving forward into the sort of the New Deal era and World War II, I was wondering how both the civil religion of crude and also wildcat Christianity, as you call it, influenced the emerging idea of an American century, and also other kind of parallel developments like modernization theory and America's expanding influence in global politics.
Well, certainly the 1930s, 1940s are a crucial period for this. We know of the quite famous, of course, article that Henry Luce publishes just at the beginning of World War II, in which he calls for an American century to take root. By that, he means that it is time, of course, for the United States to shed its isolationism and to become internationally engaged, not just internationally engaged, but to take the lead in that. It is now incumbent on America and Americans to look at themselves as a leader in the world. And again, that resonates deeply with the Rockefeller family and the Rockefeller wing of oil. They too, of course, are going to see liberal internationalism as a project that America, that the United States needs to lead going forward. And so that kind of philosophy gets connected very directly to the power that American oil brings in its international engagement. I mentioned in the book, it's quite instructive, I think, to note that a month before Henry Luce published this very famous, very important article, he spoke to an association of American oil men, and there charged them really with the task of extending kind of liberal democratic values to the rest of the world, to sell, to use oil and oil monies, to use oil exploration and expansion of the oil business as a means to modernize and develop what he considered undeveloped regions of the world. And of course, that's going to become important as well in the late 40s and 50s, as the United States is not simply trying to sell this gospel of human humanitarianism, human uplift, and global development to the world on its own terms, but is also going to be, of course, very anxious to shore up its interests abroad, to protect its interests, protect its allies from expanding communism as well. And so the Cold War, of course, is going to heighten this initiative. So I hope, does that clarify?
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. So just looking a little bit more at wildcat Christianity in Texas during this period, how did oil interact with things like Pentecostalism, the rise of the prosperity gospel, and that very quite distinctive religious culture that's brewing at this point?
Well, I mean, one of the more fascinating turns in the book, I think, at least for me, and it was certainly a turn in the research, was what happens in East Texas in the 1930s. We, of course, know nationally what's going on in the 1930s. 1930s, the Great Depression, which is destroying much of America's rural hinterland, as well as the city life, economics of that. But here, in 1930 itself, at the very dawn of the Depression, in four counties in northeast Texas, the poorest counties in this state, at a time of great poverty everywhere, experiences an unprecedented oil strike in the East Texas fields. It's the largest field, most voluminous field discovered up to that point in the entire world. And so throughout the entire decade of the 30s, there is going to be an explosion, really, of oil drilling and oil activity across this region. Why else does this matter? Well, the major oil companies are going to be hesitant to send their geologists into this region. They do not believe that the strike, at least initially, is anything but kind of an accidental thing and something that is not going to yield anything much. It is going to allow these independent oilmen, already prominent in Texas, to be the first on the scene. And there they are going to really expand their economic and political power in really profound ways throughout the 1930s, in a way that's going to transform American politics. And again, we can talk more about that if you'd like. Now, how does this affect religion? Again, wildcat Christianity, very much alive and well by this point. But here in East Texas, this is a place of especially heightened, tense evangelical fervor. This is going to get linked to the oil business itself in ways that are have never been really before. Already kind of evangelical, already fervently evangelical, wildcat Christianity now is going to be embracing a hysteria, if you will, a wildness that is quite new already to this sector of oil. You mentioned Pentecostalism, for instance. This is a region where Pentecostalism is already prominent, but the spectacular arrival of oil, but as well as the damage done by oil, the ways in which human bodies are damaged by the appearance and the spread of the oil industry in this region. Fires, a common occurrence, death, a common occurrence. There is a sense within this booming cycle that also oil is something that needs to, that religion can offer meaning and hope and healing in this moment of great upheaval. And so the notion, for instance, of healing becomes very important. Healing services are a very common occurrence in East Texas at this time. That is particularly important to the Pentecostal tradition. And also, again, this notion that the poorest of this region are now have within their means the possibility of great riches. Poor churches can now tap into the oil monies of the region and enjoy this new prosperity. This is God-given. This is something that can be used for the furtherance of the church. And so this kind of prosperity gospel, something we're more familiar with perhaps in more recent days or recent years, is something that I think emerges anew out of East Texas in the 1930s.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Several scholars, including yourself and in your previous book, have sort of pushed back the explanation of the rise of the religious rights sort of into the 1950s and 40s. How do you see your account of the link between oil and religion feeding into that narrative?
Right. Well, it does. It is important in a number of ways. I'll maybe just highlight a couple of, I won't say necessarily interventions, but I guess we could call it that, interventions in scholarship on the religious right. First of all, yes, the timing of this is important. It tracks it back. It does especially connect the roots of the religious right to what is going on in the 1930s, for instance. And that has been talked about elsewhere, including my prior work, kind of this distrust of the federal government, really kind of capturing the hearts and minds of evangelicalism across the country, fears that with the New Deal, we are seeing the expansion of the federal state, which is in turn reining in the kind of the abilities of individuals to live life on their terms. And this is, again, how evangelicals are seeing it. They are fearful that with the large state, federal state, we also see socialism and secularism creeping into the country. So this is a national phenomenon in many ways, and it's driven also by evangelical businessmen who are worried about what the New Deal state is doing in terms of empowering organized labor, as well as reining in, as they see it, the interests of the free market and of businesses. But what I would add to that is, again, what happens in East Texas at this time. No businessmen are going to become more powerful within the church than oil men. And that is thanks, again, to the great wealth that many wildcatters experience and enjoy in the 1930s. And so they are going to be able to empower institutionally a religious right network that will extend itself well past the 30s, of course. And secondly, I guess what is important about the 1930s and this clash is that it is over land regulation. It's over the ways in which the federal state tries to bring order once again to a chaotic oil industry in the East Texas fields. And so this fight is going to be about family values, but it's also going to be a fight over fuel values, about who gets to control production, who gets to control the means of production and manage the industry. Independent oilmen want to protect their independence and do so at the cost of big oil, major companies, and big government. And that sentiment is going to carry throughout the post-World War II years. And so this second intervention, I think, is an important one if we want to try to understand, for instance, evangelical right-wing politics in the 1950s, the fight over who gets to control the offshore oil in the tidelands, a battle that brings Eisenhower into the picture in 1952 as the candidate, the Republican candidate, that will protect the interests of Texas and Louisiana and states' rights to this offshore oil, that will also protect the independents' rights to work those fields. Billy Graham and evangelical preachers across the Southwest are going to join this fight on behalf of states' rights. That's crucial, and this is a battle. This is a way in which a religious politics of protest is really driving key turns in petroleum itself. And I could talk further. I could give you, of course, the example of the 1970s, and perhaps we can return to that. But in any case, those are some of the interventions trying to make the religious right can't be understood unless we extend, again, this timeline, but also draw the quotidian kind of factors of energy and environment into our calculations as well.
Fascinating stuff. So looking at the sort of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, how do the social movements of that era interact with the oil industry? I'm particularly thinking about the civil rights movement and the rise of environmentalism.
Well, for sure, of course, those movements are going to bring change on a massive scale in American society. Oil is going to be very much at the heart of the clash. So, for instance, civil rights. Here, the companies that are going to get attacked the most are major oil companies because they are most heavily invested internationally. The oil industry as a whole, I point out in the book, is the whitest of all industries in the United States. Up until the 1960s, mm-hmm. I believe the workforce in American oil only 3% black, and that is a statistic that extends really across the entire history of oil. So there's a way in which this is already a racist enterprise across the board, whether independent or major oil. So oil as a whole is going to be come under attack by civil rights activists, people who are going to see the oil industry as racist. They are going to carry out boycotts, for instance, of oil companies at the pumps. Sunoco, led by the Pew family, is going to be one of the first oil companies to be boycotted by African-American protesters. So domestically, the industry is going to be one of the corporate sectors most targeted by civil rights activists. And again, for good reason. When we think internationally, major oil companies are going to be active in Africa, places across the globe that are now decolonizing and are being reclaimed, really, by their citizens as nation states. Angola, across Africa, of course, countries emerging at this point. And within that kind of political context, international oil companies, Gulf Oil, Texaco, Standard New Jersey, Standard New York, are going to be targeted by those people as evidence of Western influence, of Western evils, the evils mm-hmm. of capitalism within their own homes. So they too are going to attack American oil on that basis. So civil rights, decolonization, all of this is really kind of changing the way American oil itself can operate in the 1960s. The second movement you mentioned, the environmental movement, of course, the 1960s and early 70s seems to be a time of unprecedented crisis in oil. Oil tankers spilling their materials in a number of different shorelines, along Cornwall, for instance, but also most famously or infamously in Santa Barbara in the late 60s. And so at this juncture, these environmental disasters brought on by oil are going to awaken the environmental movement here in the United States in a way, again, that couldn't have been imagined even a decade prior to that. Oil will be seen once again as a hellacious curse on the planet and on humanity, and so will be the ultimate symbol of really an America gone wrong. And so environmental activists will target oil companies again with a special fervor, and as a symbol of as a whole through the 1970s, oil will be deemed again once as they say all that is wrong with America at that juncture.
Super interesting stuff. So shifting our gaze to the 1970s, there are sort of two related questions I want to ask you about that decade. And the first one is, how did the kind of declining confidence of America and the diminishing sense of American exceptionalism affect the relationship between religion and the oil industry?
Well, again, America's the United States is kind of possession of oil, and throughout the 20th century, of course, oil is a global story. It is there are other, of course, nation states heavily invested in this business. But oil has a special hold on the American soul, and the United States as a whole also enjoys supremacy in oil that seems to be, through most of the 20th century, unquestioned. The 1940s and 1950s, with global exploration, major oil companies are enjoying great discoveries, wealth that are going to come out of that. That begins to unravel in the 1960s, once again, thanks to decolonization, thanks to the rise of other oil-producing states in the Middle East, Libya, for instance, Venezuela and South America. Those nations, those societies are going to want to take control of their own commodity. And so all of a sudden, major oil, American major oil, is going to start to feel the effects of that, the backlash against them, but also the diminishing returns in many regards. In the 1970s, the energy crisis, of course, is going to make this a much more pronounced problem for major oil. Saudi, Aramco even, is going to start to fall under the control of Saudi leadership rather than U.S. leadership. That's going to culminate in the final takeover of Aramco by Saudi Arabia in the 1980s, early 90s. And so once again, the oil, the gas consumer back in the United States is going to feel the pain as well, the pain at the pump, as OPEC dries up oil prices through an embargo, for instance. So all of this is kind of undermining the supreme faith that Americans had in their kind of international engagement, and an engagement that was in many ways tied to their own kind of control of oil and the economic wealth that provided. And that registers also within kind of the civil religion of crude, within the Rockefeller realm of Protestantism. There no longer is the same confidence that oil monies can help Christians, American Christians, transform the world in their image. And so by the 1970s, the civil religion of crude itself becomes attacked and begins to dismantle. And with that, a faith, again, in a social gospel of transformation.
Okay, so my second question about the 1970s is, this is the decade where we see an obvious fracturing of the New Deal order, the post-war liberal consensus, and then the rising power of the right, and a kind of sharp rightward turn culminating in the election of Ronald Reagan, of course, in 1980. And so how does the narrative of wildcat Christianity feed into this turn?
Well, I think in very important ways. What's happening in independent oil in the 70s itself? Well, amid the energy crisis, Americans, again, are going to become wary of big oil as they see it. And here they're registering that with an understanding of the major oil companies. They're going to come to believe that major oil companies have put America in a tenuous spot internationally. They are convinced that it's major oil that has caused the energy crisis of the 1970s. And so that is really a culture of crisis that independent oil men can step into and become much more politically powerful. How so? Well, independent oil men have always focused primarily on domestic production because of their limited means. They have not been able to work abroad as major oil companies. And so they embody really an America First energy program. And that program now becomes more appealing to the American public. Independents are saying, look to us. We are the patriotic Americans that will take care of your economic needs. Let us drill on domestic soil with more fervency, and we will be able to guide America out of this energy crisis of the 1970s. Many of these independent oil men are themselves devout evangelicals. Many of them, of course, are supporting churches and supporting emerging religious right causes. And so here, what I say is the kind of the family and fuel values get merged together to create a more politically powerful wildcat Christianity. And so I alluded to earlier, we know about the rise of Reagan's religious right in the 70s because of abortion, for instance, opposition to abortion, opposition to the ERA, opposition to gay rights. And all of that is essential and important. And many of the oil men that I look at within the wildcat Christianity that I talk about are themselves wanting to shore up traditional values, pioneering family values of yesteryear, and they are going to pour their money into religious right social politics. But they're also wanting the churches of the Southwest, they're also wanting evangelicals to join them in the fight against heavy federal regulatory oversight of oil. They're going to speak out against Jimmy Carter's energy plan, which again calls for a reduction in oil, calls for greater regulation. And in that way, they are going to expand their fight on behalf of the Reagan right. And it's important, for instance, it's exactly 40 years ago, next month, that Jimmy Carter delivered his what would become known as the Malay speech, in which he kind of chastises the nation for its over-reliance on energy, oil in particular, asks for more conservation, asks for more regulation. that would become a rallying cry for independent oilmen across the Southwest. He will anger them in the way that he, again, speaks against oil, and they will, in turn, embrace what Ronald Reagan has to offer. Reagan is going to tour the Southwest, campaign across the Southwest, and there at large churches and religious gatherings, he is going to espouse evangelical social values, but he is also going to preach to petroleum kings and promise them that he will deregulate the West, that he will get the federal government out of environmental protection and allow independent oilmen once again to work the land as if it is theirs. And so that is the message of America First. That is the message of the fuel and family values at the heart of wildcat Christianity. And it's no wonder that he wins them over in 1980. And Reagan, of course, becomes the face at that point of this new Republican right.
Fascinating. So there's a tension, as it were, in modern American conservatism between sort of economic liberalism, deregulation, etc., and the social side of things, the social cultural side of things that emphasizes tradition. And so do you feel that your narrative of the oil industry and its relationship with religion partly explains how that circle could be squared by modern conservatism?
I hope so. I hope that's a takeaway. I think we've seen other works emerge that are problematizing that sharp divide, because there is really, in fact, not a sharp divide between this libertarianism and social conservatism. Evangelicals on the right in general are fiercely protective of their personal rights, their individual rights. They also recognize, however, that there has to be, of course, a certain moral centeredness in which individuals can thrive as individuals within their families, within their community life. So there is a built-in social conservatism as well that holds together this libertarian vision of the world. This is all the more evident in the oilmen that I study, all the more evident in the oil patch churches that I study. They do not see this divide. They see the values of a fiercely free market and social conservatism as shared, as twin pillars, really, of their political agenda and of the political necessities of their campaign.
Great. So shifting our gaze to the present time, obviously President Trump was elected in 2016 with overwhelming support from evangelical Christians. I think 80% voted for him in the end. And also he's then gone on to deregulate substantially many of the environmental policies that were introduced during the Obama period. How does wildcat Christianity fit in to this moment where we have both strong support for Trump and also environmental deregulation?
It's very much at the heart of this Trump moment. And, Mike Pence, for instance, was just in the Permian Basin, West Texas, in late April, atop a new oil rig of an independent energy company, announced that the three pillars of American greatness were faith, freedom, and vast natural resources. And so this is really the language of wildcat Christianity that I show emerge throughout the 20th century. And it's culminated, one could say, in this Trump moment. What Trump has done is really revamp the America First energy program of Ronald Reagan that I spoke about just a few minutes ago, and really has used that blueprint to recapture, to consolidate the soul of Southwestern evangelicalism in particular. He has, again, as you say, not just proclaimed an America First energy policy. He's not simply sent out, members of his administration to talk God and oil extraction and gas extraction to the people of the oil patch, the people of the Southwest. He's also acted on that. He has, of course, deregulated almost on a daily basis. We get new news of kind of the deregulation of Western lands. All of this is greatly exciting and empowering to independent oil men, especially. In fact, there's a story that emerged, I believe, about 2 months ago of a tape recording of the of an annual meeting of the Independent Petroleum Association of America, at which point independent oilmen gathered were actually laughing at the degree of access they have to this presidency. So this is a moment of great celebration among independent oilmen. And on the oil patch itself, Donald Trump really represents their interests, not just their social values, but also their economic interests.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us today, Darren. Just one final question. This might be a little bit too soon since your book is published this month, but do you have any plans for your next research project?
Well, yes, this is kind of a moment of a little bit of anxiety. You're never quite sure what's going to happen next. You know, when I started this oil book, it was actually before the first one was done. I had so I had something to look forward to, and something I was anxious to get at. I'm not quite there at this juncture. I have a few ideas that I'm pursuing. One of them would be kind of a brief follow-up to this book, and it would be more of a travel log meets comparative history. What I would propose is a study of a number of global oil patches to see if there is such a thing as oil patch religion, universals of what I see in the Southwest. And it strikes me, for instance, that almost across the board, the oil patches of the world tend to be the most conservative in terms of religion and politics, whether it's Saudi Arabia and Oman, whether it's the oil section of Norway, which is the most evangelical section of that country, whether it's Indonesia. So it strikes me that there's something at work here. Petrocapitalism produces a similar worldview based on the boom-bust cycles of oil. There's something that is similar, so there's similarities between Odessa, Texas, as I say, and Oman in some regards. Strong belief in an all-powerful God who gives and takes, but who's always there. A very kind of powerful eschatological view of the world and understanding that the world will devolve into crisis, salvation coming only through, once again, an all-powerful God. So that's one project that I'm considering. A second one, which I will probably get to here in the coming weeks and months, is a micro-history of a resort town in California. I won't get into details, but during the 1950s and 1960s, this town undergoes a series of environmental crises. Drought dries up the lake on which this town's economy is based. And with this environmental crisis comes a heightened extremism of politics, of religion. Deaths occur, a number of very interesting court cases. So I'm curious to see how, once again, if we look at land, if we look at environment, if we look at weather and climate, how does that affect the religiosity of a place and by extension, get kind of funneled into a politics of extremism, something that, of course, we're going to be more familiar with going forward with climate change and so forth, and that's already been witnessed in Africa and elsewhere. So those are two projects that I'm considering, and hopefully one of them will grab me here, and I'll happily invest for the next few years. But I'm also eager to try something a little bit different. This book took a number of years and took a lot of energy, and I'm not quite ready to dive into another project of this scale.
Great. Well, they both sound like fascinating projects, and I very much look forward to seeing whatever you produce next. Thank you for being on the program today, Darren.
Thanks for having me, Stephen. It was a real privilege.